Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hey guys, this is Cher Martinetti.
And Adam Swiderski.
And welcome to another episode of The Churn. And this week we're going to be breaking down episode 302, IFF, or
IFFF. Yes.
Yeah. With and joining us, as always, is James S.A. Corey, a.k.a. Ty and Daniel, because Ty is here this week, which means the abuse on me will begin.
Exactly. There was something missing from the last episode.
Yeah, I was feeling entirely too good about myself. That's what it was. Say hi, guys.
Hi, guys.
Oh, God, I missed you.
He lurks in the darkness.
So we were just talking about this, and I want you to tell the story, and I cut you off before you got a chance to tell it. But Ty, so you said that the episode initially had a different name this week.
Yeah, when Daniel and I wrote it, the name we put on it was Hammerlock, which, of course, they talk about in the episode as it's an old fighter plane term where if one plane is behind the other in a position where they really can't be shaken off, that's called getting them in the hammerlock. It means that the other plane is about to be shot down. So we co-opted that term for Bobby to use about the missile lock range with the UN escort ship, and the whole first half of the episode is Bobby and Vassarala trying to stay out of the hammerlock. And I just like the word hammerlock, but Narain didn't want to use that because Narain hates Joy. And part of that is, well, and part of hating Joy is that he dislikes things that are good.
Okay.
So instead he changed it to IFF. I don't know why he thought that was better. But okay. I give him no end of shit about it.
Okay.
It's true. There is no end of shit.
I 1,000% believe that. So before we get down into a breakdown of the episode, Adam, what did you think of this week's episode?
Oh, man, it was action packed. I really dug. I mean, I'm always a fan of a good space battle on the Expanse, and this gave us a really, really good one. I love seeing the Rossi, you know, with PDCs blazing and executing all kinds of Newtonian physics aided maneuvers. And so that was really cool. And then I am intrigued about the political slash UN side of things and meeting a new character. So I don't know if we want to talk about that yet or in detail, or I can just say that as a teaser. But that part is going to be, I'm really curious as to how that's going to play out. And you know, again, given the preview that we got from Daniel last week about what's coming up with Sean Doyle and some excellent work from him, I'm curious to see if we're going to see Elizabeth Mitchell be a part of that, or if it's a different track that the political angle here is going to take. So anyway, that was my take on the episode.
All right. I dug it. I was into the episode. I also like when I see the space battling happen. I also like on the Razorback, whenever they start to like take off and those two wheels that they're strapped into, the seats like start turning. It just looks fun.
Yeah, the design of the interior of the Razorback is really, really cool. I don't know
really
if you guys have any.
It's really cool, but it also just looks fun. Well, let me rephrase that. It looks like Frankie thinks it's fun. I don't know if Shirai thought it was as fun, but it looks like it's fun. So, like, did those actually turn, guys, or are those all just like after effects?
No, that was a real thing they built. Both wheels rotate about 70 degrees in each direction. And then inside of that rotating wheel, the chairs can tilt completely flat forward or back. It was all computer controlled so that when the camera moved, did a certain thing, the chair moves would do a certain thing. And it was all the camera crane and the chairs were all sort of tied into a single computer to make all the moves work.
That's pretty crazy. Was it fun for the actors? Did like everybody want to take turns riding on it?
You know, actually, a bunch of people did. I know the president of Alcon, one of the co-presidents of Alcon, Andrew Kosov, wanted to ride in it, and he was, I think he was one of the first people who wasn't like the builders of the chairs to get to ride in it. So if it had failed and fallen apart, we would have killed the guy who owns the company that makes our show. So I'm really glad. I'm really glad they built it well. But yeah, I mean, it seemed like everybody had a lot of fun. I asked them to do something that I think made it more fun, because when they were first testing it, they were doing a lot of tilting forward in the chair, and I think that wasn't fun. That sucked. Anytime they tilted the chairs forward, you had to like kind of hold yourself against the back. But I went and talked to the guys, and I said, there's no reason they would ever do that. So take the tilt forward out of the program completely. And then I think it got a lot more fun, because then it was just side to side and backwards.
Yeah, it looks fun. It looks like a fun, like a carnival ride, like before it gets like obnoxious, though. But I liked the interior design of that ship a lot. I like, you know, Frankie looks like she's really having fun with Bobby. Like, because now we're seeing more of Bobby, but we're seeing, like, you know, the snarky, like, no fucks left Bobby, which I think is great. Because, you know, obviously last season, that character's story arc, she was, you know, dealing with a lot of pressures and a lot of shit and her PTSD. And it was fantastically done by Frankie. But I think this season you see a little more where she's, like, the rebellious streak and the badass streak is starting to come. That part of her personality is coming out. So I really like that. And I have to say, I think this is the first episode that I genuinely liked Holden.
Ever?
Well, yeah. Good.
Well, yeah. I love Steve. I adore Steven. I know Ty thinks I adore him in a different way, but I adore Steven as a person. I think he is so nice and a doll. But Holden, I was like, oh, God, you're so insufferable. But this was the first episode where I think you started seeing, or I felt that there was a side to his personality that was coming out, that it wasn't, I don't want to say that it wasn't something, but I felt like there was more empathy and in him, and that, you know, the concern that he had for helping Prax and for doing the right thing, it didn't seem as self-serving as it came across earlier. Not that it was self-serving before, but it just for something about it just seemed like he was so, you know, again, like this, the, you know, the pro molecule is his whale, you know, absolutely. But it just always kind of felt like he just couldn't listen to reason outside of that obsession with the pro molecule. Whereas now it's like he's gotten past that and he's doing something that's really for almost like a greater good, because it's selfless. It's not about his need to have to get that pro molecule. It's more about servicing another person. So I just kind of feel like this is a layer to his personality that I like him better now.
You know that the protomolecule is an extinction level event, right?
I do. So yeah, I know. I get
like
that.
Being obsessed with stopping the extinction of every human that has ever lived, that, I don't know, that feels like the right, that feels like the right thing to do.
It wasn't the wrong thing to do. I think that the way I was taking it is that he was so obsessed with it that it's like he wasn't really, he couldn't see past that. And I understand the intent was the right intent.
What we did last season was we broke him.
Yes.
We gave him a grand quest, mm-hmm. and he failed.
Right.
And now I've always said this about Steven and Holden. Steven has the hardest job here because Holden has the longest arc in the story.
Mm-hmm.
He's the one who's, you know, a lot of this hangs on. And so, you know, we've now come to the point where we've had the first real turn in his character's story. He was the one who was going to be the righteous guy and the hero. And then he rode in and he just failed. And was betrayed by the people who he held most dear, and now is trying to put the pieces back together. And part of putting the pieces back together is finding the thing that he regrets. And what he regrets is he didn't actually help this guy find his daughter.
Although I think it's really telling that as soon as Holden finds that compassionate cause, it immediately gets sidetracked by completely other stuff.
Right. Yes. But hold on. I want to get back to that for a second, because the whole failure thing, I think what for myself, it makes me think of the whole thing in The Last Jedi, how Luke goes. Oh my God, my dogs. Sorry. How, as you can see, I'm recording from home. How Luke gets all like, oh, the Jedi are failure. And he's like pouting about it. And, you know, obviously he has other reasons. I get it. But when Yoda says to him, but that's part of the lesson. It's not, you know, the failure is, it's not actually a failure. And it's like, I think maybe seeing him fail, and maybe it's just I like when a man's been broken. I don't know. But I think that the lesson of failure, I think it humbled him in a way. And I think that that humility didn't really exist in him before, which is fine and okay, and I understand it. But for myself, I think now that there is a little bit more humility to him, I find that there's an aspect to his personality that I actually like him better now. I don't think ever a bad guy. I just feel like there was an arrogance maybe to him, and there was an obsession level to what he was trying to accomplish. Even though it was the right thing, there was something about it that was like, I don't know.
Although on the other hand, like, think in this case, he still gets fixated because it's not his decision that leads to them, you know, taking a detour to go rescue Bobby and Avasarala. It's Prax's decision. Like, if it had been up to Holden, they wouldn't have done it. So he still has that like single-minded fixation.
He does complex. But this time someone else is making the decision, whereas I don't know that in the past that they would. It would have been like, well, this is what I said, so this is what we're doing. You know, whereas now it's like, yeah, he still wants to do this thing, but he's actually allowing other people to kind of call the shots a little bit more. I mean, this is all my perception and my read of it and how I'm taking the character.
Sure. Daniel, you were going to say something, I think, and I cut you off. I'm sorry.
I have no idea what it was.
No, it was it was the one thing that would unlock the character of Holden for all of us and make us understand him on a certain level, right?
I don't know. We have a lot more story to tell. If I unlock everything about him as a character right now, I got nothing to do. That's a terrible plan.
But like, can I also say though, like, I think that's one of the things I appreciate too, is that as the seasons go on and as the story goes on, you know, the characters are going from one thing to another. Like they're evolving, or you're unlocking these different aspects to them, or these other layers to them. And for me last season, I think the biggest shift from season one to season two was 1000% Amos. You know, it's just, I started seeing Amos in a completely different way, and he became my favorite character last season. And I think, you know, again, like, Steven does have the longest story arc with Holden. I think it's just now, this is another layer to him in that character that's been revealed. And it's like, oh, okay, well, now I'm kind of seeing him a little bit more fully formed. And it's starting to make me feel differently towards that character.
Well,
which is
I'm
a good thing, which is
succeeded.
A really good thing. Like, that's, none of this is a negative. I'm just saying it's really good. And it's, I appreciate that as a writer and as a viewer, like, how that character is playing out.
Good.
Here's what I want to know.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Here's what I want to know. How much fun was it to toss Wes around in that scene during the space battle? And was there more abuse heaped on him than originally expected?
I mean, that's what we always do with Wes. That's his job on the show, is we hang him on wires and bang him into things. So we just did it again.
He sells it though. I mean, he absolutely just physically convinces you that he is holding on by his wrist with his full weight there and struggling. We didn't tip the set. We didn't actually, you know, throw him around, but he makes that look good.
He's probably our most physical actor. In that he, you know, like Daniel said, he can really sell the physicality of every scene that he's in. And he enjoys getting yanked around. He enjoys getting banged off of things. Whenever we put a stunt double in for him, he's upset about it. He doesn't like it. He wants to do it himself. So yeah, you know, when we're hanging him from wires there and pulling on him and stuff, I think he's having a great time.
I'd be curious to see if he would share that assessment. I seem to remember him last year having some gripes about being banged around, but that was
His gripe was when we hung him from a wire and the director forgot he was there.
Oh yeah. Right.
which I think is a completely fair gripe. I think he's absolutely right about that. If you're going to hang your actor from wires, remember that they're
yeah.
I really dug that scene because I just love these little reminders especially during space flight and things like that, that this takes place in a more realistically depicted sci-fi universe where you have to worry about, you know, tools being buckled down or else they're going to fly around the room and possibly impale you during maneuvers.
Yeah, I don't remember seeing that scene in anything else before. I don't know what we were calling back to on that one. I think that was us.
Yeah, no, and to be fair, and I think I mentioned this on Twitter briefly, but all of that came out of a conversation with the director, Breck Eisner, who was going through our first draft of the script with Narain and said, and in the first draft of the script, we had a different version where Amos was by himself and he was doing some other stuff. It was similar in that he was getting banged around, but the setting was different. And he Brett asked, you know, can we do something here that we haven't seen before? And maybe use this moment to connect Amos and Prax a little more because, you know, we're trying to build that relationship. And Narain brought that to Daniel and I, and the tool thing is the thing that sort of we all came up with. And I think it turned out great. I think it was a good suggestion for Breck to get Prax in the room and help build that relationship. And I think, you know, as far as a danger in zero G or in changing gravity goes, I think the flying tools worked out really well. And I'll give some credit to Narain for that too. I think he was one of the ones. Yeah, I think that was one of the ideas. We were sort of shotgun tossing out ideas, and Narain was like, well, what if, you know, what if they were in a spot and things were flying around in the room? Could we do something like that?
You know, one of the things that has been really interesting to me in this whole process is how little the credit of who wrote the script reflects the number of people who actually put their hands on it and were part of the process. This is an episode that has, you know, is credited to me and to Ty, and it has a lot of other people's expertise and input and creative energy in it. So, you know, it's great that we get the credit, but there's a lot of folks in there.
And it was just a lovely little reminder. I think I've read this elsewhere and about actual spaceflight, about how these little things that you don't even think about, you know, when you're on Earth can kill you. You know, like the thing they say in for NASA is like the smallest bit of fire and you're totally screwed, you know, because there's so much pure oxygen in those compressed little tin cans. So seeing anything like, oh, these little tools who you might not think would be a deadly thing in that type of situation turn into a deadly thing was a lot of fun for me.
I enjoyed it, too. Nothing like watching people you care about in deadly danger.
Of course.
I also wanted like just jump back to earlier when you said about throwing Wes around, and this is not a spoiler, but I do know for a fact that someone does something more worse than that later this season than anything that's happened to Wes.
Oh no, we do terrible things.
Yeah. Someone shared an experience they had during filming that I apparently missed when I came up there, because it happened like the night before. That was is okay. More revealing.
I just want you to understand, with that context,
yes,
I have like four or five things you might be talking about. We're just terrible. I believe that
1,000%.
Harsh thing.
So one of the things I also really enjoyed this episode, or I found interesting or intriguing, was when Alex makes the argument about like, hey, this is a Martian that needs help, when Bobby's sending the distress signal. And how he argues his case, how, like, you know, everyone else gets to, like, you know, Naomi's helping Belters, you're helping Earth, like, and now it's time for me to help Mars. And I think it's, I think it brought a whole new level of an interesting dynamic to that group, because you see that for, especially with Alex, someone who's like, oh, this is our family, this is our family, for him to assert himself and also to stand up for, like, hey, this is, I am a Martian, like, these are my people and I have to help them and I deserve that same opportunity and respect and say that everyone else gets to have. I just felt like it brought another layer into that entire dynamic of the group, where it's like, yeah, they have become this makeshift ragtag family, like Alex likes to say, but at the end of the day, like, they are representative of very different factions and very different players in this game, even if they don't share those views and they don't want a war, they still are beholden and loyal to their people. And I really liked that scene. That was a really good scene.
I think Alex is getting a lot of really interesting moments so far this season. I think that's really gratifying to see that.
Yeah, it's a good season for Kaz. He's getting a lot of juicy stuff to do, which, you know, he's earned it. So I'm glad he's getting it. But, you know, I mean, the thing that we often forget as an audience is we have privileged information. So we, as the audience, know that Avasaral and Bobby are on that ship that's calling for help. And so we want them to be saved because they're characters that we follow. But if you just look at it from what the crew on the Rossi knows, Holden is absolutely right. There's war going on all over the system. There's probably 1,000 distress calls going on at any given time. They can't go to them all. I mean, his position is actually the correct one. It's just because we, as the audience, have some privileged information that we're like, well, you know, why is he arguing it's going and saving those people? It creates some interesting sort of tension in the viewer's mind that that we really hope he does something that actually is a terrible idea.
Well, and that undercuts, you know, he part of the work that we did with the script was, you know, last hour we had him dedicate himself to saving this missing child, to trying to track down this missing child and atone for having blown this guy off and used him for his own agenda. And now something shiny happened, so he's going to not do that. You know, that's, we couldn't do that. We couldn't have that happen. That's part of why it was so important to have Prax be part of the decision to detour, to put off going after May, which is,
it had to be Prax's decision,
and that it was Prax's decision. The reason why Prax would do that, I thought, was also kind of heartbreaking.
Oh yeah, I loved that scene between Amos and Prax where Amos kind of calls bullshit on his reasoning and tells him what the real story is. That was just such a wonderful character moment for those two guys on top of the action moment they had before.
Those sort of moments come out of, I read an article talking about the Better Call Saul, or excuse me, the Breaking Bad writers room, and how Vince Gilligan liked when the writers wrote themselves into a corner, because some of the best scenes, some of the best reveals and moments in the show came out of the writers desperately trying to find a way to get out of the corner they'd written themselves into. And so what we wound up with is a moment where Prax has made a decision. He's thrown his vote to to going and rescuing these two people. And we couldn't think of a reason why that would be true. I mean, in the original discussion in the writers' room, everybody was like, well, that would have to be what happens. And so it was sort of penciled in that way. But when you actually start writing the script, you're like, every reason for doing that is just bullshit. and none of it makes any sense. And so Amos's confrontation of Prax is, it comes out of the conversation Daniel and I had about that moment, that why on earth would he do that? And,
yeah, your daughter is in danger. She's, why don't you go? Why don't you burn everything in order to get to her sooner? And then there's an answer, and the answer is
because she's already dead.
Yeah, and right. I don't want to see it. I don't want to look.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, I mean, Daniel has a daughter, and in our conversation, I kept saying, what wouldn't you give up if Scarlett was in trouble and you had to go save her? And Daniel's answer was nothing. I would set everything on fire. I wouldn't even think twice about it. And we had to find an answer that was true and also true to what Daniel was saying. And both things had to be true, that a father will do anything to save his kid, and there is a thing that would cause a father to not
to blink, to look away.
Yeah. And both things had to be true. And that was the only answer we could come up with. And the only person, I think, in our show, the only person who can really perceive that is Amos. I think he's the guy who sees that.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say that's interesting because Amos doesn't strike you as the compassion character, right? Or the character who's going to think about the emotional side of things as a reason for doing things. And to have it come from him, I thought it made it more, all the more striking.
Yeah, Amos is very clear on reasons why you would betray a child.
Yeah.
Amos has a lot of experience on why and how children are betrayed.
Well, and that's why I love that, too, because it was this moment. It's just like the scenes in the brothel, you know, in previous seasons, everything. It just gives us a little bit about Amos's character that we don't necessarily know, but kind of fills in a little bit of the background blank in a neat way. I mean, obviously, you know, there's a lot more there, and those of us who have read, again, our namesake novella, The Churn, are aware of more of it. Are you guys going to, without spoiling too much, are you going to delve into more of his background in the future?
I'll let you know when we hear from Sci-Fi.
All right, there you go. But you would like to is the answer, I'm guessing.
Well, if we get to spend more time with the character, I would love to spend more time with the character. You bet.
Yeah, because that's, as a reader of the books, I really loved The Churn as a novella, and I would love to see that on the screen or some aspect of it anyway. But I guess we'll have to wait and see. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to ask you guys, like, what was your favorite part of the episode?
There were a couple of things in this one I really liked. And I haven't rewatched it this morning, and it all kind of blends together. This is the one where we had Elizabeth talking about collective punishment, right?
Yeah.
So I loved that we got her, we got Anna in here, and one of the first things she does is point out that all of that stuff Avasaralo was saying last season that we were all cheering for was a war crime.
Right.
It's like, okay, yeah, punishing their families for something they did, that's actually kind of a terrible thing. Oh, right. You know, it's easy to forget that when Shore is the one saying it. So having those two be clearly very different people, I thought was really good. And from a just aesthetic perspective, that last bit where Bobby is carrying Avasaralo across, and we see Bobby, and then we see Shore reflected in the docking tube, and then we see the stars beyond that one.
Yeah, what a shot that was. That was so cool.
That's all credit to that one goes to Noreen. He knew that one was going to be there going in, and I think he got what he wanted.
Well, that was a fight, because Noreen was very clear on that shot and what he wanted it to look like, and specifically said, here's what I want. And through the entire, I was on set, I was producing that block of episodes, so constantly that we were getting pushback that, like, oh, the visual effect wasn't going to be able to do it, or the special effect wasn't going to be able to do it, or the set wasn't going to be able to do it. And I sat in meeting after meeting after meeting going, the showrunner said he wants this. Are you telling me we can't have that? Should I call the showrunner and tell him he can't have the shot that he wants? And after about the 10th time I said that in a meeting, everybody was like, all right, we'll find a way. And then we finally got it. But it was like, I don't know why that particular shot was such a fight, but it was every department pushed back on that one.
I was going
to
say,
and to the credit of those departments, they delivered beautifully.
Yeah.
Once they did it.
However hard we made it for them, they did rise to the occasion.
Yeah, they all rose
God
to the
bless
occasion.
Them all.
They made a gorgeous shot, but it was such a fight.
I was going to say, of all the VFX stuff that happens in the show, for that thing to be the sticking point.
You know, apparently that sort of transparency is tricky.
Okay.
In a visual effect, and I'm not sure the technical reasons why, but that kind of shot is particularly difficult to do, especially when you have a mix of real things and visual effects sort of in the same shot together.
The other thing, though, that I wanted to say something about was is specifically to Ty's credit. It's the choreography of that fight between the Rocinante and the UNN ship.
Oh, good, because I was actually going to ask about that and like who choreographs your space battle. So that's great. It leads into it.
Ty is a genius at choreographing the space battles and in finding ways to do things that we haven't done before. So it's not just, oh, another dogfight. Ooh, another, you know, it's finding something genuinely new to do with the tools that we have. And I thought that the way that one came together with setting up the way that the explosions overload the sensors and then doing that with the Razorback and then playing that with the one big screen that the Rocinante screams through at the end. That's another thing I don't think I've seen before. And I thought that was... I admire Ty's ability to come up with those over and over and over and over again. And I'm really glad because I don't have that talent. So I get to take some credit for it.
Ty, can you talk a bit about your process when it comes to coming up with that type of stuff?
I don't really have a process. I just things that we've done before aren't interesting to me. You know, I mean, and Noreen, for some reason, Noreen has given us all the space battle episodes. Every time we do a big space battle on the show, Noreen has Daniel and I write it. So we've gotten to do a lot of these, which is cool. It's a lot of fun. But I mean, we have a couple of different constraints. One, we try to be relatively realistic with the physics. So we're not going to have a dogfight. We're not going to have a ship chasing another ship like a fighter plane, like Star Wars does. And we don't do the sort of motionless firing at each other that Star Trek does, the sort of submarine warfare where they park and shoot at each other. So in between those two things, what can we do that is interesting and doesn't look like something you've seen before? And I just play around with it. I mean, there's lots of pictures from the writer's room of terrible drawings on the whiteboard. That's almost always me. I'm almost always, I'm getting up and I'm going, well, you know, the ship could do this. And then, you know, wind up with all these like lines on the board that are incomprehensible to anybody who wasn't sitting in the room when I did it. But,
yeah, especially later in this season, we have a lot of diagrams.
Yeah. The physics are realistic. Physics are not intuitive because we haven't grown up watching them on TV and in movies. I mean, we've grown up watching Star Wars, and so, you know, planes that are dogfighting and chasing each other through canyons, spaceships chasing each other through canyons feels right, feels real, because that's what we watched as kids. So when you
mess with it,
when you do the realistic version, people don't understand it. Like, it doesn't make sense. There's a lot of diagrams drawn on boards to make everybody get it.
I'm kind of disappointed. I was expecting you had like a full 3D holographic display that you could walk through and move ships around as you were plotting all this out. No?
No.
No, we just make stuff up.
Yeah.
That's good.
I make stuff up and then I draw it on a whiteboard.
Very high tech.
A couple hours explaining it to everybody.
I was going to ask one more thing about the space battle, but I forgot. Oh, and the other thing that struck me about it is the distance too. And that was something from the books that I remember is, you know, that these ships are thousands of kilometers apart. It's not like they're, you know, like you said, turning and burning right next to each other. And the way that's conveyed in this episode, I thought was really cool, that you're squaring off against this ship that's so far away, but you really don't have a lot of time because of the speed everything's traveling. It just makes it that much more distinctive, I think, in terms of space battles that we've seen on screen.
The other thing that's weird about this particular battle, and I took a long time to explain this to the first to Noreen, and then later to the visual effects department, is this is the first, I think, space battle I've ever seen where all three ships are burning in the same direction, but they're not all traveling in the same direction. So, I mean, because you've got the Razorback racing away from the escort ship and the escort ship chasing it. And then you've got the Rossi trying to get in formation with the Razorback, but to do that, its engine is pointed in the same direction, but it's decelerating toward the Razorback. So they all look like they're going the same direction, but the Rossi's actually hurtling toward the other two ships. That's just, it's weird, and it's not intuitive, and it kind of messes with people's heads. And you have to keep explaining to visual effects, the Rossi's nose isn't pointed toward the other two ships. It's not burning toward them. It's decelerating so that it can come into a sort of matching orbit with the Razorback. Because that's, again, you know, Star Wars has trained us that if a ship is flying toward another ship, its nose is pointed at it.
Right.
Yeah. The visual storytelling on this is really hard to be accurate with and then still be legible.
Yeah.
Cool.
But, and then, you know, we're going to do some easy.
I got it. I all got it. But let's go back. You know, we talked about Anna very briefly, but let's really dive into that, because obviously this Elizabeth Mitchell, a new addition to the cast, Anna, a new character who we're meeting for the first time. Do you guys want to kind of break down, I guess, the Elizabeth Mitchell of it all? How did she end up becoming involved? And then B, kind of how the character is being written for the show?
Well, Elizabeth became involved because we asked and she said yes.
Yeah,
she's fantastic.
You heard it here first.
She's fantastic, and we were lucky to get her. Before we had asked anyone, we sort of kicked around a bunch of ideas on who could play that part. A lot of names came up, and we sort of bounced them around and talked about them as possibilities. But the truth is, and I didn't know this because she's played a lot of different characters. Elizabeth has played a lot of different characters, and she clearly has range. She's played a lot of different kinds of people, but if you meet her in person, she just radiates sort of kindness and warmth and this gentleness. Like her, so no matter what she's played on the various shows and movies that she's done, her just sort of her default personality is the most like Anna that you could possibly be. So, like, we didn't know that. We just know she was a great actress, and we asked her if she would want to do the part. She said yes, which was great. Then she came into the offices when Moraine and I were there in the EP's office, and she came in and sat and talked to us for a couple minutes and then left. And I was like, holy shit, we just cast Anna. I mean, that was like, that's her sitting there talking to us right now, because she was so gentle and so kind and so warm but still really intelligent, you know, which Anna needed to be very intelligent.
And very committed.
Elizabeth is a great actor, but I don't know how much acting we asked her to do on the show, because she's basically, I think, playing a version of herself.
Yeah, her energy, I'm sorry to cut you off. Her energy was very, because I met her when I came up there, because I did the EPK for this season with all the cast, and which Ty knows because he gave me shit the entire time. But she is like, her energy is exactly that. It is like super like nice and kind and like warm, even just talking to her for a couple minutes. So it's pretty accurate.
And it's as a character, Anna is, a very strange character to see in science fiction. You don't tend to see characters in science fiction who are religious. You don't tend to see people who are pious, who aren't either, the villains or part of an extended sermon on the part of the author. So that's it's a little strange to have somebody come in who has that strength of their convictions and is in this setting. It's just it's kind of a weird thing.
Yeah, it is. In sci-fi, aliens are allowed to be religious because they have weird space religion, right? They have they worship the Crystal Mountain, or they worship hyperspace or something. And for some reason, that's okay in sci-fi. But humans with actual human religions generally are not seen.
Yeah.
And especially, as Daniel said, especially in a sympathetic way. but this was true in the book when we wrote it in the book, and it's also true in the show, is massive, you know, perspective-changing events, such as, you know, discovering that alien life actually exists and that we're not alone in the universe. There's a lot of different ways to analyze that, and one of those lenses through which you can look at those events is a religious lens, and it feels incomplete to not include that.
It's interesting because that you say that about how usually in science fiction and in fantasy, whenever somebody is pious, they do tend to be the villain. And about aliens, like, it's good if they have religion. And it's true, like, because every example I can think of, usually it's like religion is the thing that's driving the villain to have these incredibly orthodox or extreme views. And I wonder how much of that is influenced by stuff that just plays out in the real world, you well, know, and how often
there's been a lot of horrible, horrible people who've done terrible, terrible things
in the name of religion. Yeah,
that's absolutely true. And on the other hand, Mr. Rogers was a Presbyterian minister, and
right.
he
didn't do anything horrible. You know,
I know.
Those people exist too, and they don't tend to get a lot of attention or press.
Yeah, and I mean, and there's definitely a cynicism, and I'll admit to it at times myself, because I don't, you know, I don't believe in a higher power, and I'm an agnostic or atheist, however you want to frame it. But I grew up Catholic, and it's weird because I've myself have found times where I do have, if someone's a little too religious, I'm like, I'm almost put off by it, which is not fair of me to do, because they may be incredibly lovely people, and what somebody believes and chooses to follow and believe in their ideology, as long as they're not hurting other people, I actually genuinely do not care. And I'm all for it. But yeah, it's just, it's interesting because that does happen. We really don't see someone like an Anna that's pious and also just a genuinely good person. That's such an underrepresented character and trait.
Yeah. Well, and when the book came out, we had a certain percentage of people responding to it online saying that, oh, finally, our religious agenda was coming out, and this has all been a stalking horse for evangelizing for, I guess, Methodism. I don't know. Maybe. Sure. Why not?
That insidious Methodist agenda.
Yeah. Which is not true. I mean, we are neither of us as pious or as good as Anna. She's a character we made up, but for a reason.
When I think, I mean, that's interesting too. Another thing I think of when I think of that is the movie and book Contact by Carl Sagan, and how when Ellie is being vetted to go on the trip, you know, they ask her about whether she believes in God or not. And they make the point that I think, I can't remember the percentage, but like 90 something percent of the Earth's population and ascribes to some vision of a higher power. And so, you know, to not have that in
the what was that? That was when the book, society. This is that in the book or?
It's in the movie.
Yeah, but a woman, that movie came out what, like over 10 years ago, right?
Oh yeah. In the '90s.
Yeah.
I guess what I'm saying is to have a movie or a depiction of a future Earth society or human society that completely eliminates religion, you know, doesn't take that into account. And I think that that's why it's good that that's there. It's like, oh yeah, this is still going to be a factor in human society for the foreseeable future, you know?
Well, and people got this weird idea because of the Nauvoo and how important it is in the show and in the books that like there are people like, oh, are the Mormons the only religion that survived into the future? And of course that's not true in the books or the show. So it's nice to have a reminder that no, there's lots of religious people. That,
yeah.
Lots
Methodist
of different
here,
religions. You know, when you go through when Miller in the second season is walking through Tycho Station and goes to the Mormon church to talk to the Mormon elder, and he goes through sort of religion row, there's buildings for like every religion there. There's like a synagogue. I think that one of the signs is for like a Muslim place of worship. I mean, there's like every kind of religion is represented. There's a Buddhist thing. every kind of religion is represented, but people only remember the Mormons. So it's nice to remind everybody. No, it's all of them. They're all still there.
Yeah, everybody's there. We all made it.
And I think the humanist side of the character is very interesting too. You guys mentioned this earlier because I think that especially as a viewer, when you are watching all these political machinations and things, it's like I studied geopolitics in school and so in college, and you can get very into just thinking about, you know, lines on a map moving around, and then you have to take a step back and remember that every time one of those lines moves, like thousands of people die or something like that. So having a character who kind of brings it back to that level is a nice refreshing point of view for, I think, even for the viewer, in addition to the characters who are in the show, to remember that, you know, there's actual human, what's the word I'm looking for? Human cost to a lot of the stuff that's going on.
It's also interesting that we got to bring Anna in early this time. She didn't show up in the books as early as she's showing up in the show, and nor is she showing up in the same way. This is actually one of the big changes, and there are a lot of changes this season generally. A lot of places that we've diverged from the books. This is one of them I think really worked. I think what Anna as a character has to say in that kind of political realm was really interesting. Was a really a nice thing to see.
Is she being set up as a foil for Aaron Wright?
What do you think?
I certainly think so, but I didn't write the show, so I don't really.
I think so. I'm gonna crow about Sean Doyle again because I'm such a Sean Doyle fan now. There's a moment at that dinner when she says her whole thing about collective punishment being a war crime, and Sean shoots her a look without saying a word. That I think is some of the best physical acting in our show, because that look says, "Oh, you are my enemy, and now I must destroy you." and he does it with a smile. He looks at her and he smiles, and you can see he is like psychically trying to set her on fire in that moment. I think there's a nice little, and I don't think she's aware of it at all. Anna has no idea that just happened. She has no idea she just created a powerful enemy.
She's been dropped into the Viper's nest.
She has no idea. But Sean, I think, Aaron Wright definitely knows and is going, oh, I'm going to have to destroy this one to get what I want.
Yep.
Interesting.
Well, it's also interesting because the foil we've had for Aaron Wright up till now has been somebody who was as good or better at the politics than he was. Only now she's out on a racing ship out of her element. And we have Anna, who is totally a fish out of water, in the corridors of power, trying to make some sense of it and not make the world a worse place by making an error.
Yeah. And it was really important. This was a topic of much discussion in the writer's room. It was really important that Anna not be a Vossarala light.
Yeah.
That she not be just another version of a Vossarala. It was something we really, you know, Narain was really good about monitoring this, but we all kind of had to keep an eye on it because there was this tendency to write her like we would have written a Vossarala for all the writers. And I'm so glad we didn't, because at this version where she has no idea what's going on, she's not a Vossarala. She doesn't know how to play the political game. Like you said, she's dropped into a nest of vipers, and she doesn't even know she's in a nest of vipers. Like, she doesn't see the vipers. That's a much more interesting thing. It's not something we've already done, and I enjoy it a lot. And the thing is, like, all of our major characters now sort of are out of their element. You know, Holden's no longer chasing his white whale. Naomi's on the outs. Anna's in a political realm she's never really been in before. Vossarala's in a racing ship. So we're pulling everybody out of their comfort zone. The only person who's in her comfort zone, which is what Cher brought up, is Bobby. Bobby's back in her comfort zone. You know,
oh, people are trying to kill me.
Yeah,
okay.
Last season she was the fish out of water. She was going to the beach. She was in politics and didn't understand it. The beginning of the season, when missiles fire, she just flips. She's like, oh, now I understand what's going on, and now I'm in charge. And she just takes charge, just starts bossing a bosser all around. Because this is being on a ship that missiles have been fired at and needing to fight a bunch of guys while you're wearing your power armor, that is absolutely what she understands.
So, shout outs.
I'll go first.
Okay, go first. It's like everyone gets quiet. I love that you guys always make me feel like an asshole.
No, it's cool. First, I want to thank Daniel because I picked up Space Opera after you mentioned it last week, and I'm really digging on that. So thank you for that recommendation. And then I know it's another network's science fiction show, so I don't know if this is in the best business interest, but I've been watching some Lost in Space on Netflix, and I have to say I don't have a huge attachment to the old show, so I'm not hung up on a lot of the changes, which there are very many significant ones. But I'm kind of enjoying it. It's kind of got a Spielberg-y vibe, kind of the darker side of Spielberg-y vibe, a little bit of Lost in there, the TV show Lost. And it's as someone who doesn't, you know, have a huge attachment to the old campy version, this more serious version is something I'm finding very compelling. So there's my shout out.
Wasn't Elizabeth Mitchell in Lost?
She was in Lost. It all comes full circle.
Drawing shit back.
Yep.
Gentlemen, Ty, Daniel, what you got?
If we're talking about science fiction shows on other networks that we admire, I'm gonna haul out Counterpart.
Hey, you stole mine.
I went first. No, yeah, Counterpart. I just finished watching the first season of it, and I think it's takes a very difficult concept and handles it very well, and J.K. Simmons is astounding. I think he's done an amazing job with his role in that one.
Yeah, Counterpart is great. And our buddy Amy Berg is an executive producer and writer on it. So it's nice to see people that you like
doing well
and getting the praise they deserve for their work.
So Ty, is that also your shout-out, Counterpart?
I was going to say Counterpart because I've become very picky. I don't like almost anything. So the fact that I really think Counterpart is amazing should tell you that it's a really, really good show because I hate almost everything.
The thing that I love about it is that they have this conceit that's just this weird, bizarre thing that has happened. And at no point do we try to figure out why. At no point are we given a backstory. Well, you know what happened was the flux capacitor teched the. It's just like, okay, so here's how it is now, and that's just how it is, and now we're moving forward. Given that that has happened, we just got to go. And it's such the right choice, and I know how tempting it is to go back and try to explain the inexplicable. And it could have gone so south so fast, and it just didn't. It was great.
I love stuff like that. Have you guys seen the movie Primer?
Yeah.
Yep.
I love that about that, too, where it's just like, we're not going to tell you why this is all happening. It's just happening, and you got to figure it out. I love that about that movie.
I want to go watch. I actually saw an essay that was kind of tracking everything in Primer so that you could follow what was going on, because that's a movie that requires a careful rewatch.
Yeah, definitely. It's
really smart. Really smart script.
Hey, Cher.
Hi.
What do you want to shout out this week?
No, I'm going to do two things. I'm actually do a little bit of a self-promo and a shout out. So like the plug self-promo is I'm going to plug this week's Strong Female Characters podcast, which is our Fangirls podcast, because Gwenda Bond is our guest and we talk about Lois Lane, because it's her 80th anniversary today, well, because it's the 18th, when everybody hears it. But everybody's been, you know, yay, Superman. But dude, it's also Lois's 80th, because she also made her debut in that same exact comic book. And I don't think Lois gets enough shine or love, and I'm a little disappointed. So I think that's what I want to plug.
Gwenda is awesome.
Gwenda is
amazing. As a writer and as a human being, she is just the bee's knees. She's great.
She's so funny, and we completely went off the rails during this podcast with her, because we just were talking about everything, and then at one point we started talking about the thing that I am going to shout out, which is also on Netflix if people have not seen it. And I know this sounds weird after me saying how I'm like really not into religion. I'm obsessed with anything that has to do with cults. Just completely obsessed. So right now on Netflix, if you haven't seen it yet, I recommend everybody watch Wild Wild Country, which is batshit bananas. Like, it's probably one of the best documentaries I've seen on any topic. But it's such an insane story. For anybody who doesn't know, it's about, if you ever heard of Osho, who's a spiritual leader out of India. Before he was
Most
calling,
people know him as the Bhagwan Rajneesh.
I was going to say, before he was calling himself, he rebranded as Osho. And it's a very crazy story that, to be honest with you, at different times during this documentary, you find yourself kind of empathizing with literally every single person in it, because it's like they all have a point, and then they're also doing incredibly horrible things. And it has everything. I mean, it has everything. It's a whirlwind. It's an amazing documentary. I highly recommend it to anyone who has not seen it and who does not know the story about them. I don't want to spoil it, because they get into it deeply in this, and it's intense. So Wild Wild Country is my shout out.
I lived in Oregon when that was going on.
Shut up. Did you?
That was the Oregonian. That was my local newspaper.
I mean, the whole thing is like insane. Like, I didn't know until I read articles that have come out after, because they don't say it in the documentary, but they talk about the hotel bombing that was owned by the Rajneesh that happened in Oregon. Yeah. And they were saying how it turned out that was actually like an Islamist militant that did that. But they said in the documentary who actually was responsible. But I have to say, like, most documentaries I've watched, I tend to come out with a pretty clear, like, oh, like, this is where the documentary was kind of going with this. But I didn't feel that with this, because at one point you kind of understand there's obviously like racial profiling happening. There's religious persecution, but there's also classism. You know, there's so many layers to this that it's really, you start feeling one way and then you start going through it and you're like, oh, wait a second, because it's really so layered and it's just so much happens. It's intense. If you haven't seen it, Ty, like, totally watch it. Totally watch it.
No, I have seen it.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it's...
I was going to say, I think you sympathize with everybody in there except that lady who was his second command is just flat out a psychopath.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's I have to say, you don't sympathize with her.
She has scary lizard eyes.
She scares me. She scares me for a lot of reasons. And I think that this is also starts to come where, like, it goes back to what I said earlier, where someone is too religious, that I get a little taken aback or put off or turned off by it, because I think at some point, like anything in life, whether it's religion or ideology or food, anything, if you are too extreme about it, you tread into basically becoming the very antithesis of the thing that you claim to be about. And she's a prime example of that. So, yeah, Wild Wild Country. Definitely, that's my shout out this week.
Except for Expanse fandom, everyone should be as obsessive about that as humanly possible, right?
No one should be obsessive. No.
There is too obsessive.
Yeah, no one should be that obsessed about anything. But with that note, thank you, everybody, for once again listening to the podcast and for your, you know, engagement on social media, and keep on, you know, sharing both the show and the podcast with your family, friends, and coworkers. And, you know, give us, if you have the chance, give us some love on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you always to Ty and Daniel, who are so gracious with their time and do this with us during the season. And Ty, for being incredibly subdued and not making fun of me once the entire episode. I'm actually a little worried about you. Do you guys want to tell everybody where to find you on social?
You said your back is hurting, so...
Thank you. You took pity on me. I appreciate that. Do you guys want to tell everyone where to find you on social media in case they don't already know?
Well, I am on Twitter at Abraham Hanover. And we're also, there's a website, jamessacorey.com, where we're putting together a newsletter So that's a good way to keep track of, you know, the important stuff. If you just want the piffle, Twitter, hit me on Twitter.
Yeah, you should definitely go to the James Asikori website and sign up for the newsletter, because our publisher is doing a bunch of giveaways of really complete sets of signed books and other cool stuff. So if you go sign up there, you have a chance to win all the goodies.
All right.
Do not follow me on Twitter.
Ty is on Twitter at James S. A. Corey, and he just alienates everybody and insults people. It's like
I'm way too in character when I'm James S. A. Corey, the crabby, obnoxious 1970s sci-fi writer. I get too much into character.
I think it's hilarious.
That's a follow at your own risk type of situation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Adam, do you want to tell people where to find you on social?
Sure, they can find me on Twitter and Instagram at RockTheFaces.
Okay, and I'm The Sharness. And you can always tweet us at Sci-Fi on Twitter, or, you know, stop by the website. And we'll talk to you guys next week.